So hello and welcome everyone to OTJR's fourth seminar of Hillary Term. I'm Gayatri, and along with my colleague Svetlina, I'm co-convening OTJR this academic year. And as most of you must already know, we are an interdisciplinary network of academics and students based out of the Faculty of Law at the University of Oxford. And we're all working on issues of transition in societies recovering from conflict as well as authoritarian rule. So today we have the pleasure of hosting this really exciting book launch. A very, very warm welcome to Dr. Eliza Ganzi, who is the author of The Justice of Visual Art. Eliza is a British Academy postdoctoral fellow in international relations at the University of Cambridge. And she's currently in Australia as an honorary associate at the Centre for International Security Studies at the University of Sydney. And her research focuses on art and visual culture in international relations and world politics, particularly in relation to human rights, transitional justice, and conflict. But before I turn to her, so we can all hear about this wonderful book, I have some really quick housekeeping rules for everyone to keep in mind. Please keep your video and microphone turned off throughout the webinar. And please note that we will be recording this presentation and sharing it as a podcast. And finally, if you have any questions for Eliza, please indicate so in the chat. And when we call upon you, you can turn your microphone and video on and ask your question. Alternatively, you can also type your questions out in full in the chat and ask me to read them out. That's it. Eliza, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you so much. Well, I'd like to start by saying a very big thank you to the Oxford Transitional Justice Network for welcoming me to present in the seminar series, and in particular to Gayatri and Svetlina for all their work in organising today. And thank you so much to everyone for coming via Zoom and being here despite various time differences, because I can see names of lots of people that I know are in many different time zones. So thank you so much. I'm really delighted to be launching the book today with the network, because this book arose out of my PhD research, and that research was really shaped by seminars I attended at the network and many people who I've met through the network. So it's really lovely to kind of do that full circle and be back here, albeit virtually, talking about the book today. So in the next little while, I'm going to introduce the governing thought which underpins my research, and then I'll talk about the key contributions and the major claims the book makes. I'll flag these very briefly at the outset, and then I'll go on to elaborate on them in more detail. But being a book on visual art, I have lots of slides to share, and so I am going to share my screen. And let's just get that working. There we go. So, when governments sanction mass violence against people within their borders, and when large portions of a population commit human rights violations against other parts of the population, how is it possible to reconcile nations and achieve justice? Because it's not simply possible to imprison large portions of the population, and really no single legal measure can possibly comprehend or respond to the very diverse claims of both individuals and groups who have been affected either directly or indirectly by conflict. So what else can be done? The governing thought that underpins my research is that there are aesthetic and creative ways to pursue transitional justice. And these are ways which have the capacity to address identity divisions and exclusions in order to understand and respond to the diverse claims of people affected by conflict, as well as the intergenerational trauma, social injustices, and deep grievances, which are both the result of conflict, but also its long-term cause. And so this is an argument that really speaks to current debates in international relations, human rights, and transitional justice, as well as art theory and memory studies, around how best to address violent and traumatic pasts, how to reconcile divided nations, and really how to strengthen democratic institutions in the aftermath of conflict. So in the book, I use a detailed case study of post-apartheid South African visual art in two major state-sponsored institutions in order to demonstrate that there are these aesthetic and creative ways to pursue transitional justice. And these institutions are the South Africa Pavilion at the Venice Biennale in Italy. And the Biennale is a global art exposition that brings together around 85 states to stage exhibitions. And the second institution is at the Constitutional Court of South Africa, which houses a large visual art collection developed by the court and for the court. So as part of my doctoral research, I conducted about 11 months of participant observation fieldwork at these institutions. And that fieldwork included 130 interviews with key stakeholders, such as judges, government representatives, staff members, artists, and visitors to these institutions, as well as archival research. So this is really the kind of the data and the kind of material that I'm drawing on throughout the book to make the arguments. So the book makes three key contributions and corresponding arguments. First, it develops a theoretical framework for understanding transitional justice in visual art. And this framework shows how art plays a vital role in shaping and communicating the narratives of individuals so that they take on collective importance. And in doing so, the past can be shared so that a new political future can be imagined. The book also develops novel conceptions of visual jurisprudence and cultural diplomacy as forms of transitional justice. And when I talk about visual jurisprudence, I'm very broadly referring to it as the theory of the visual in law. And so one of the main arguments I make is that the art collection of the Constitutional Court of South Africa is a kind of visual jurisprudence in which the assumptions of justice and what it actually means to uphold the new constitution in the face of an apartheid past can really be probed. I also argue that the narratives of transitional justice, which emanate from the South Africa Pavilion at the Venice Art Biennale, position the state as continuing to heal its internal wounds while actually constructing itself as an archetype of political transition in order to re-establish its membership of the international community. And so the book substantiates several claims. These are that art enables and supports transitional justice. Art communicates justice in powerful and meaningful ways. Art embeds justice on different political levels, both the local and the global. Art becomes a radical form of political participation in times of transition. And art is critical to the perception and the provision of justice in South Africa. So consequently, art needs to be more widely considered by political institutions. And as a result, the research in the book really shifts legalistic conceptions of transitional justice, which at the inception of the field tended to dominate, because the book demonstrates that a holistic approach to transitional justice needs to include legal, social, and cultural processes in which visual art has a significant role. So, moving on really to unpack the three key contributions of the book in more detail, I begin by developing the theoretical framework I mentioned. And I do this through a close visual analysis, really a narrative investigation of one artwork. And this artwork is Rewind by Gerhard Marx, Maya Marx, and Philip Miller. And this was exhibited in the 2013 South Africa Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. So Rewind is an audiovisual installation, and it's based on testimonies given during the public hearings of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So it consists of operatic cantatas, which really present an archive of reimagined voices in an act of remembering, and also of images which respond to these testimonies. So the artwork really embodies a literal and a conceptual meeting point between transitional justice and visual art, because the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, unfolds through Rewind, and Rewind is given form through the TRC. So the images on the screen show Rewind as it was exhibited at the 2013 Venice Biennale and some of the film details of one of the films in that installation. But to give you a sense of the artwork, I'm just going to play a short excerpt of one of the film. And this film is based on the testimony of Eunice Mia, who is the mother of one of the people killed, Jabulani Mia, during what later became known as the Guguletu 7 incident, which is when in 1986, seven young anti-apartheid activists were shot by members of the South African Police Service.
One of the children was shown on TV who had a gun on his chest. Only to find out it's my son, Jabulani. I prayed, I said, oh no, Lord. I wish this news can just rewind.
So I look at Rewind, and I use Rewind to develop a theoretical framework which is based on four key ideas that make art exigent and meaningful to transitional justice and vice versa. And the first idea is about the circulation of political sentiment. And that is memories and emotions, what I group together as sentiment, really circulating in Rewind, generating an expectation that the process of reconciliation begins with the projection of a past that is in need of remembering, and a past that must be remembered so that it's not repeated. The second idea is about the mediation of political agency. Political agency is mediated through the retelling of people's stories and through the reimagining of their testimonies in artistic form. In Rewind, people are visible and become visible through the processes by which the artwork came to be created and exhibited. Through the experience of the artwork and its mediated truth, and through the associations that the artwork really sends out into the world. Because politics revolves around what is seen and said, but also who has the ability to see it and say it. So the third idea is about the invention, or invitation rather, of political encounters. Rewind performs a kind of transitional justice in the openings that are invited by aesthetic encounters. The TRC, for instance, is aesthetically reworked. Its visual spectacle is evoked through the hanging line of headphones of the installation. At the same time, the TRC is questioned through the way in which the testimonies are selectively transposed and received. And it's through these encounters that the artwork becomes an artistic intervention into South Africa's larger transitional justice narrative. And the final idea is about the invention of political space. Rewind invites and invents both physical, symbolic, and effective spaces which shape and reflect how South Africa's transitional justice narrative is performed. It presents an image of a state seeking to continue its internal wounds while offering itself up as an archetype of transition. And so the theorization of these four ideas really frame two central arguments in the book. And the first argument arises out of a general meeting of art and transitional justice. And that is that an account of transitional justice without aesthetic dimensions is insufficient. And it's insufficient precisely because transitional justice is a process that's inseparable from feelings of justice, from justice being seen, being felt, and being thought to be done. Artworks can offer insightful visions and experiences which really leave an afterlife beyond their creation. And they can fill out effective topologies in ways that facilitate or stimulate recognition and feeling of experiences. They can provoke us to travel into other people's worlds, thinking and feeling our way into their universe. And this recognition is really essential in order to comprehend and respond to the diverse claims of individuals and groups that are affected by conflict. So this is a normative argument that really underpins the book. And on that note, I just want to play a very short second excerpt from the artwork, which really emphasizes this idea about feelings of justice and effective connections prompted by the artwork. It's an excerpt that's based on testimony by a mother about the murder of her son, who was shot by security police at the age of 11.
Then someone calling out for me.
So the second argument I make that emerges from Rewind in relation to the theoretical framework is that art plays an important role in animating and activating the narratives of individuals so that they really take on collective importance. Rewind shares individual stories of pain and suffering so they can be effectively accessed and interpreted by viewers. And in doing so, the past of one person becomes the present of many people, so that hopefully together a new political future can be imagined. And the importance of establishing really a shared collective vision of the past has become something of a trope in transitional justice discourse. So examining Rewind offers aesthetic insight that's both central to understanding South Africa's transition and simultaneously constitutive of that transition. The artwork functions to produce and maintain the state's transitional justice narrative, but it also opens up spaces for new political thinking, new possibilities and new actions in that narrative. So the invented physical, symbolic and effective spaces of Rewind shape how South Africa's transitional justice narrative takes on both domestic and international significance. So in part one of the book, I explore transitional justice at the national level through the Constitutional Court of South Africa. Established at the point of transition from apartheid to democracy, the court was built on the site of several former notorious prisons, and probably the most well-known of these was called Number 4 prison, where virtually every political prisoner in South Africa in the 20th century, including Mandela and Gandhi, was incarcerated at some point. In the image on the screen, you can see the rainbow facade of the court, and to the left of that, under the corrugated iron roof, is part of the old Number 4 prison, and this is now preserved as a museum. So the court space, or the court building, is really a unique space by international comparison, not only because it has transformed this penal site, but because it also incorporates artworks into the fabric of the building and houses a large visual art collection that was developed by the court for the court. So I've included three images on the screen, really just to give a sense of how art is integrated and displayed at the court. On the left of the screen, you'll see the public entrance doors to the court, and these display South Africa's Bill of Rights carved in sign language into the wood. In the center is the public entrance foyer to the court. And on the right is the public art gallery, which connects the court chamber to its library. So by tracing the court's development with a particular focus on the unique policies and processes through which the art collection came into being, I argue in the book that art has been a central component of the most significant institution to emerge out of South Africa's transition, and it continues to be so. The court is focused on justice and it's founded on art. And when establishing the court, judges, they weren't on the sidelines as really mere future inhabitants of the courtroom, but they were on the front line pushing and prioritising art to be at the heart of this justice institution. So I then go on to examine the spatial politics of the court. And the court's art collection, and architecture are intended to symbolize the values in the Constitution. So I explore five themes that are critical to justice, which are really dominant in the discourse of the court, both in how people speak about the court and in how the court portrays itself. So four of these themes refer to the values rooted in and fostered by the Constitution, and these being accessibility, equality, dignity, and freedom of expression. While the fifth theme, which is justice under a tree, really relates to a process of South African constitutionalism that's embedded in a regional vernacular and post-apartheid identity formation. So I critically analyse each of these themes by examining how specific artworks and architectural features intervene in the appearance and the performance of the court, shaping how the Constitution is understood in different ways. So these material interventions and the space they create, I suggest, are really key to the provision of justice at the court. So one example I explore, and I've included an image of this on the screen, is William Kentridge's print entitled Sleeper Black. In interviews, people who work at the court they regularly cited this artwork as an example of the right to freedom of expression. And they said this for two reasons. So I've included a quote on the screen from one interview which speaks to this. So on the one hand, the artwork is an example of the right to the freedom of expression because it's an image of a nude man. The artwork is perceived to challenge conventional paradigms of female nudity in artworks and stands in contrast to really portraits of male judges that are perhaps normally encountered in courts. So adding to this, the subject of the print appears to be lying in a vulnerable position, in contrast to images of nude men, which when they do appear in artworks, tend to be in positions of power, if you think Renaissance depictions of the ideal male body. So it's not just the artwork is of a nude man, it's that the artwork is of a vulnerable nude man, which appears to be significant. On the other hand, the location of the artwork contributes to how it supports freedom of expression. It's an image of a nude man hung prominently in the public entrance to the court, and it's one of the first artworks encountered at the court, or it was when I was there. So it's not just important that the artwork depicts a vulnerable nude man, it's significant that this artwork is encountered early and at the very entrance to the court. So it's these two provocations about content and location that combine to connect the artwork to the right to freedom of expression, suggesting that this freedom arises from the ability to show an image of a nude man in a civic institution, which in the book I critique as a rather thin conception of freedom of expression. Yet it's unexpected in the context of the court because such legal spaces are conventionally circumscribed by perhaps more conservative aesthetics. So it's not that the artwork itself is about freedom of expression. In another context, Sleeper Black might be considered really an innocuous image of a man in a cartoonish style. However, placed in the court, the artwork takes on new meaning, and as a result, the justice institution affects the artwork. And in turn, the art reinforces a notion that's central to conceptions of justice, that of freedom of expression. So linking this back to the theoretical framework I mentioned, the encounters generated by the artwork and the space it creates are really important actions in the perception and provision of justice at the court. I go on to explore three dominant narratives which I argue emerge from the court's art collection. And these are narratives which recognise people, community and time as really key to the project of justice and democracy in South Africa. So these narratives play a role in shaping the court's larger transitional justice story because they draw attention to how the impossibility of attaining universal justice is what actually drives justice practices and the enactment of human rights for particular people in particular communities at particular times. So one artwork I suggest that epitomizes this is a series of body maps created by the Bambanani Women's Group in Cape Town. And I've included an image of two of these on the screen. So each body map is a self-portrait created by a woman who is HIV positive. And these body maps came out of a workshop which was part of Medicine Sans Frontières pilot antiretroviral program. The process of body mapping, which is a form of art therapy, was intended to help women come to terms with their diagnosis. At the time of the workshop in 2002, antiretroviral drugs were not available through public health centres. And this is a position the Constitutional Court sought to change when it ruled on access to HIV/AIDS treatment and the right to healthcare, requiring the government to provide access to these health services, particularly for pregnant women to combat the transmission of HIV from mother to child. So through these body maps, there is really a direct visual connection between the practice of justice that's enacted by the court and the artworks because it portrays who is the subject of judgment and what is the purpose served. So I conclude this part of the book by theorising the court's art collection as a new kind of visual jurisprudence. And I analyse the ways in which people, especially judges, talk about the art collection in order to show how artworks of the court become central to the bodies of aesthetic knowledge that shape the appearance of justice and that shape how justice is understood. So on the screen, I've broken a key rule of PowerPoint presentations and put far too much text on the screen, but I really wanted to include quotes from some of the interviews about how judges think and feel about the art collection. Because both the judges quoted on the screen talk about the importance of the art collection in creating empathy, really, and enriching their understanding of humanity. As the first judge says, art helps one understand the healing conditions better than the law does. And the second judge says, art makes me in a sense softer, more human, and able to understand human beings a lot better. While the law clerk talks about art as creating an awareness of the bigger picture and the importance of the detailed work of the law. As the clerk says, it's only through those emotive reactions to stories that we remember the deep importance of the difference between a semicolon and a colon. So I argue that in such close proximity to the court, the art collection really inhabits a unique position in which the assumptions of justice and also of justices and what it means to uphold the Constitution can be probed. So this creates a visual jurisprudence that reflects both the values which underpin the court, as well as the ways of practicing justice in post-apartheid South Africa. So in part two of the book, I explore transitional justice on the global stage through the South Africa Pavilion at the Venice Art Biennale. Every 2 years, the Venice Biennale brings together contemporary art exhibitions of around 85 nations. It draws in heads of state, ambassadors, ministers, and diplomats who want to participate in and really assure the quality of their state's representation on this global stage. It's a Goliath exhibition that really aims to take the pulse of contemporary art and the pulse of a nation's identity, as well as capturing a global artistic moment. So it's really a global political opportunity. In the book, I start this section with a historical overview of South Africa's relationship to the Biennale, because in 1968, protests at the Biennale changed how it took place. And these were part of the student protests that swept the globe at the time. These changes included banning South Africa from exhibiting at the Biennale, which really reflected the global cultural boycott of the apartheid regime. And it wasn't until 1993, with the prospect of political transition from apartheid to democracy, that South Africa was really invited back to the Biennale. And through this invitation to exhibit again at the Biennale, South Africa was being rewarded for political change. So by chronicling South Africa's appearances and exhibitions at the Biennale, just some examples of which I've included on the screen, I explore the complex national and international politics and diplomatic negotiations which are involved in becoming, but also remaining, a member state of this international organisation. So I argue that South Africa's participation continues to be deeply affected by international and national politics. Its long absence from the Biennale reverberates through the way in which it represents itself to this international art community and establishes itself as a member state. Because since being invited back to the Biennale, the South African exhibitions have been very different to those of other states, in that South Africa has been focused on showing a historical breadth of artistic practice, really reinserting its art history back into the Biennale. And this is in contrast to other member states that tend to show very contemporary art installations, which perhaps aren't as explicitly linked to national identity. So I then examined the geopolitics of the Biennale. And the Biennale really transforms the city of Venice into a global artscape, and it has two cradles of influence and prominence, the Giardini and the Arsenali, and these are the two areas which house the majority of national pavilions. These are highlighted in red on the map on the screen. So in the garden compound, the Giardini, 29 permanent pavilions were built by states which are long-standing members of the Biennale. And these are laid out really like little art embassies. So I've included on the screen images of these, the pavilions of Belgium, France, Russia, and Germany at the bottom right-hand corner. In the Giardini are really the geopolitical axes of the mid-20th century, and it's a grouping that has its roots in post-war Europe. But by contrast, in the Arsenali, it houses semi-permanent rented spaces of states that are new to the Biennale, and these newer member states apply to exhibit. And these states are really butted against each other in exhibition spaces, which are open in the long corridors of crumbling ex-naval warehouses. And the Arsenali is still watched over by an active military base next door. So the images towards the top middle of the screen show some examples of these exhibition spaces. And the newer states, still those kind of on the margins of this art bonanza, are dotted around the city in churches, palazzos, and courtyards, all becoming temporary exhibition spaces. So states jostle for the best locations, knowing that although it will never be possible to join the imperial ranks of the Giardini, the closer they are to the epicenter, the more visible, the more visited, and the more remembered the exhibitions will be. So these national pavilions become proxies through which states present an image of themselves to the international community. And to show this, in the book I contrast South Africa's 2013 national pavilion with that of the United Arab Emirates, because these two states shared an exhibition space in the Arsenali. And I do this in order to show how comparisons between states are really forced upon them by virtue of exhibiting in the Biennale. And I argue that these artscapes provide fertile ground for states to offer an image of themselves, but these images aren't always necessarily how the states intend. So I then go on in the book to explore the exhibition entitled Imaginary Fact, which South Africa staged in its 2013 pavilion. And this was a large group exhibition showing the work of 17 artists. And what I found was there were really three key narratives about violence which emerged from this exhibition. The unresolved violence of apartheid era crimes, the structural violence of pervasive practices of discrimination, and the physical violence to which people continue to be subjected. So I analysed three artworks which I suggest epitomise each of these narratives, and I've shown some details of these artworks on the screen. So on the left is one part of David Kolwani's The Journey, which details the events which led to the death of the leader of the Black Consciousness Movement and anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko at the hands of the security forces in the late 1970s. In the center of the screen is an image of Sue Williamson's For 30 Years Next to His Heart. And this documents the apartheid pass laws that required every Black South African over the age of 16 to carry a passbook that controlled their ability to move around the country. And on the right is Zanelli Moholi's Faces and Phases, which is a series of portraits designed to restore a Black queer visibility. So I argue that these three narratives are important actions in South Africa's transition because they warn against the repetition of violence, they document the structures of violence, and they expose the continuing practices of violence in the new South Africa. But I want to talk a little bit more about Moholi's work because her practice is really interesting in how it really unsettles the state's diplomatic narrative in this particular context. So Moholi describes herself as a visual activist. And in this work, Faces and Phases, there are 10 gaps in the grid of 200 photographs, which signify the missing portraits of people who have been the victims of hate crimes. Homophobic violence is an ongoing problem in South Africa. And in particular, the nation is experiencing a backlash of crimes targeted specifically at lesbian women who are perceived as representing a direct and specific threat to the status quo. So violence often takes the form of what's being termed corrective rape, where men rape women in order to so-called cure their lesbianism. And these crimes are not only underreported due to the stigma associated with them, they are also underrecorded by the police and seldom prosecuted as hate crimes on the basis of sexual orientation. And it's a situation that contributes to the silence around such prejudice-related violence. The simultaneous presence and absence of the portraits draws attention to this violence. So while Faces and Phases is about restoring Black queer visibility, it's simultaneously an indictment of current discrimination and a call to action. Moholi is advocating for equal rights and treatment, drawing attention to the violence and discrimination faced by the LGBTI community. So including Faces and Phases in the South Africa Pavilion also draws attention to the politics within South Africa, which surrounds Moholi's visual activism. In 2009, the then Arts and Culture Minister refused to open an exhibition featuring Moholi's work on the basis that it was what the minister described as immoral because it depicted images of lesbians. And in doing so, the minister said the exhibition was against nation building. So this is a vision of the nation that's being circumscribed by heteronormativity. And this portrays really a disintegrating rainbow nationalism in South Africa, but it also echoes strategies of silencing alterity. So what's interesting is that 4 years later, Moholi is representing South Africa at the Biennale, and the next Arts and Culture Minister talks about Moholi as an important ambassador for the state. So in my interview with the Consul General of South Africa to Milan, Sol Malobi, he talked about how it was in fact vital for South Africa to exhibit Moholi's work in this context because it highlights how South Africa is different to other countries on the African continent who criminalize homosexuality. So what this shows is that there's a vast gap between the conceptual liberalness of South Africa's constitution and its political practice. Externally, on the international stage, Moholi's work is embraced, but internally on the national stage, there's a lot more tension surrounding it. So Moholi's artwork really complicates the government's diplomatic narrative by exposing the ongoing struggle for representation that exists in South Africa. So I conclude this part of the book by theorizing the exhibition Imaginary Fact really is a unique instance of cultural diplomacy. Imaginary fact plays a paradoxical role in the process of nation building, because it presents a dual image of a nation struggling with ongoing internal complexities while projecting a collective narrative of a state that has undergone a difficult transition and come out the other side to reassert itself in the international community. So by examining South Africa's conception of cultural diplomacy in government white papers, really over the past 10 years or so, I show how the official image of South Africa as a global competitor, as a transitioned nation, sits really uncomfortably with the artist's image of South Africa as a transitioning nation that's circumscribed by ongoing challenges to human rights. And I argue that this establishes a global, local, if you like, image of the state, which is really in tension with South Africa's foreign policy agenda. Just to wrap up, the South African case study really reveals that the meeting point and the relationship between transitional justice and visual art creates new critical spaces of political recognition and representation. Art is embedded in creative state building, both internally and externally. Art is fundamental to the appearance, the understanding, and provision of justice in South Africa, and of South African justice at its highest judicial level. Art is critical to how South Africa engages in international relations by asserting its successful transition while acknowledging that, justice is ongoing. And the state uses visual art from the inside out to reconceptualize the South African justice system, and from the outside in to re-engage the international community with the South African state. And so I want to leave you with one thought. And that is, without the proper recognition of the relationship between art and transitional justice, and without a deeper understanding of how and where that relationship occurs, the ability to comprehend the complex ways in which the past haunts the present is impeded. And the danger is that without art, transitional justice will fail to fully comprehend and respond to the injustices, which are the long-term cause of conflict. So as one constitutional court judge said, human understanding and the need for human understanding is actually the true link between art and justice. Thank you.